Thank you very much. You are a very kind introduction here. Unfortunately, you also date me when you bring up this 1978
I don't know myself.
Okay, so I'm really delighted and very grateful to you that I have this opportunity here to talk to you tonight. And I think the reason why I'm really delighted and excited is that I think I have something to talk about that maybe starts some fresh thinking or brings up old ideas that you have had yourself. And I think I have come up with what I think is the ideal stereo loudspeaker. Now, that's probably a pretty big claim. And it's okay if you're skeptical, so listen me out and ask me questions afterwards, and we can discuss it, and I hope it's something that will be discussed a lot, okay? But before I talk about stereo loudspeakers, I want to say a little bit about mono loudspeakers. And let's do a little thought experiment, and that experiment goes like this. Let's say you're a loudspeaker designer, and someone comes to you and says, I want you to design a loudspeaker for me that is strictly for voice reproduction, maybe just male voice. But I want it to be so good that when you put it in a room and there are other people in there and you can't see where the loudspeaker is, okay, so no visual cues, that you would be able to say, oh, there is a person speaking somewhere over in the room, it's over there, and that person is about this far away, and that person is about this tall. And when you walk up towards that person, you would probably be surprised to see what this source of sound looks like. What do you think? Do you have any idea of what you would think that loudspeaker should look like? Well, I postulate and claim that loudspeaker would probably be something like what I have in my pocket here, a larger version of this Head and Shoulder, what is it called? Simulator, right? That I picked up here out on the desk just a little while ago here, just larger in scale, so it would be a head with an opening about the size of the mouse, shoulders and a torso, but only upper torso, probably no arms, no legs or so, would be on a stand, and it would sound just like a human being speaking, so that you would confuse it with a real person. Now, you see this speaker and say, well, nice job, did a good job in designing this thing. But say you have a client and says, okay, what I really want is, I would like to have a transducer in my grand living room that sounds like a grand piano. And I want to have Glenn Gould playing the Goldberg variations on it. Okay? So can you build me a transducer like that? And I would say, well, that job is already done. And all it is it's basically, it's a Yamaha player piano. And the keys are moving. But the real trick is that someone took the recordings from Glenn Gould and translated it, and now this is where computer analysis comes into his playing style, to activate the keys on the piano in such a way that it gives the intonation, the timing, the attacks, the reverb, and everything like Glenn Gould did it on that recording. And that has actually been done. It has been a performance in Carnegie Hall, actually, where all that was on the stage was a piano. and it was a concert, you know, it was advertised as a concert by Glenn Gould. And it was performed exceedingly well and to great acclaim. So I'm talking about basically a single source, mono, okay, a real physical source right now. And I give you another example here. So assume that we had this piano and Glenn Gould playing here just one floor down on this level ground. And it was playing there. And I postulate that pretty much everyone in this room, sitting here, hearing this playing, would know that there is a real piano playing. How come? How could you tell? That's the question that I have asked oftentimes many people. What is it about the sound that tells you that it is a real piano? When you think about, like we loudspeakers, we like to talk about the direct sound and the frequency response and maybe the phase response there. Well, the sound that came from the piano down there, by the time it came here into the room, well, the frequency is screwed up, frequency response is screwed up, the phase response is not what it wants. There's a lot of reverb added to the whole thing, and yet you still, I bet you identify it as coming from a real source. So what is it in these examples, the human voice, the piano, what is the common denominator? What is it that makes us realize what the source really is, or what it is simulating? And I claim it is the what we call the power response of the source. And it is the dynamics of the source, okay? Those cues, and it is the what I call the gestalt of the source. Because we as human beings have an enormous processor here between the ears that recognizes the gestalt of different sources in different environments, and we have absolutely no problem to deal with reflections and reverberations to fish out the kinds of signals that are really of interest to us. Okay, now let's move on to stereo. And before we do, now I give you a little background and about my whole story. And I think because of age, I feel I can use some notes here so I don't get sidetracked and elaborate too much on one thing compared to another thing here. So, like you have said, I studied electronics, specialized in radio frequencies and microwaves, and this is in Darmstadt. And audio was not really my main interest, although I come from a home where my father played the piano, my older brother played the piano. I never learned it due to circumstances like World War II, so it didn't happen, and never got into it later. And in preparation and during college or university in Germany, I had to spend time working as a summer student, and I worked for Telefunken in Hanover in the electroacoustic laboratory. And I was exposed for the first time there to a stereo console. In those days, there was a big piece of furniture with loudspeakers left and right, but it was very impressive to hear this in their laboratory. I also heard there a studio monitor, which was one of the pictures you showed earlier on, a big case. But what was unique about that one, it had a plasma tweeter in it, you know, that you modulated the plasma and produced high-frequency sound doing that. It had problems with generating too much O2. And needed to but this was my first exposure, and also in the laboratory they were working at that time at a delay generator, basically a disc that was covered with tape material and had a recording head and then playback heads that you could position at different parts of on the circumference to effectively use the Haas effect in sound reinforcement systems, PA systems, and churches or so for better intelligibility. Okay? So, actually then after I graduated, I need to move on, otherwise I can't, that's why I have these notes here, so I get sidetracked. After graduating, I had my first job with Siemens in Munich, and a very interesting lab job there. And I worked on a high-speed analog-to-digital converter, 8 bits, but it was really high-speed using tunnel diodes as a switching element, and also pretty damn fast. What I was so really interested in, that has a lot to do with my personal background, I wanted to spend a couple of years someplace else before I sort of settled in Germany and stayed forever with Siemens. And I had the opportunity, I developed the opportunity to get a job in California working for Hewlett-Packard. And so that would be a very good experience for it. It actually turned out to be such a good experience that I didn't, and never came back. And so there I worked in a research and development laboratory on radio frequency and microwave equipment, which was really sort of my dream at that time. I was a ham operator, and so this was really my field there. But the good thing at HP was that the general company policy was to actually encourage engineers to do their own projects, their own jobs. You know, we called it G jobs, like government jobs. So government is very important. So this, if you have a G job, that's an important job to have, right? And so we would build things there that for our own use, like power amplifiers, low noise, phono stages, FM tuners, stereo decoders, and whatever was needed to build our own hi-fi system or to improve the performance of our cars, so electronic ignition systems. And this was the time of early transistors, so we got to, if we had all this stuff there, and we could play with it. So fascinating, right?
You did it in your spare time, I have to say.
Yes,
right?
I need to add to this. That was the requirement. It was off company time, but you could use all the resources there. So we would spend evenings, weekends, lunch hours, tinkering around and doing our side projects, G jobs, okay? Now, we all build our hi-fi systems, the power amplifiers and all this there, but the loudspeakers were really the mysterious items here. And here you see some loudspeakers from the time of that was 50 years ago. The Nobel speakers at the time were sealed box, two-way systems with acoustic suspension. Acoustic suspension was a big thing, and it was giving bass out of a small box. It required a bit more amplifier power, but that was also becoming more available now with the beginning of solid state. And so that was a big thing, and popular product at the time were made by AR or KLH and Advent. The tweeters that you see here were usually the problem issues. They would break up, distort heavily. Particular test signal was piano, like a heart attack on a piano would just crackle these things really, really quite bad. So as engineers, of course, we wanted to measure, in particular being with a measurement company, and the obvious thing that you want to measure is the frequency response, but HP was not into audio. I mean, that's we started maybe at 10 kilohertz, and audio was not part of it there. So we had to develop and build our own acoustic test equipment. We had all the parts and pieces. And so we decided to do that. And the other thing that I need to say is we looked at loudspeakers basically at like antennas. And you are already related to that, that we looked at it in terms of wavelengths. And so if you look at the acoustic frequency range from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, that is equivalent in electromagnetic fields, equivalent to a frequency range from 20 megahertz to 20 gigahertz. And wavelengths-wise, it's the same thing, you know, it's like from 17 meters to 17 millimeters. And so I was delighted to see today is one of the presents that we received here from Genelec, that when you pulled it out, it's a big surprise, this site is calibrated in wavelengths. So I think everyone working in acoustics needs to have something like this. This is your yardstick here. That's really your measure, because it applies a very, very wide range of wavelengths there. That's a real important part here. Okay. So we looked at the speakers in terms of antennas. Actually, that's how I always explained it to my friends there, you know, when they asked, well, you're doing loudspeakers. And I said, yeah, it's just like an antenna that goes from 20 megahertz to 20 gigahertz. I said, oh, wow. How do you do that? Now that's a very broadband radiator, and it gives you a lot of respect, you know, to accomplish that kind of a job there. So we didn't build our own loudspeakers, but we went to the local hi-fi store, pestered the people there basically, and because they knew we had rarely ever bought anything, but they always came, wanted to hear the latest thing that they had, trying to understand. But we did end up buying things. I had a pair of Atwood speakers, a pair of KLH 6 speakers, and then I bought, because of one of these sessions at the hi-fi store, I bought an ESS 7. Company is, I don't think, is around these days anymore. They later became famous because Oscar Heil developed a tweeter that is still has had a real revival these days. Yeah, and I was fortunate to meet Oscar Heil at the time, and we wanted to buy one of his tweeters at the time, but they cost $400. A single tweeter, he wanted $400, and that was far out of the salary range. That this is in the 60s, right? And so monthly salaries were not that high. Okay, so let's move on here. Here is the ESS-7. And the ESS-7 sounded so much cleaner than my equalized Advent speakers there. And like I said earlier, we had bit equalization. I bought a pair of those. They came wrapped with totally in black cloth. My wife was very concerned when I brought them into the living room. They just looked absolutely ugly. And one of the first things I had to do, take some open brownish, window curtain or so, really open weave, and wrap all around the thing so this looked halfway acceptable in the living room there. And then, of course, we set out to measure it. The company had published curves here. Well, we measured it, and it measured quite different from those curves. Point by point measurement. The layout of the drivers was strange again. You know, mid-range here, tweeter there, woofer here. And then it had also this little hole there. And it was called a air pressure relief hole. This is in a time before Teal Small and this whole vented stuff was really quite popular and well known. So, but nevertheless, this thing sounded good, so that was a mysterious part. And it didn't agree with the measurements that we made. But later it turned out that the key element was really this mid-range tweeter. It did the mid-range really well, and so it was very forgiving in many respects. Okay. And so we said, well, we need to do more acoustic measurements, and we just want to mention the kind of measurement analyzer that we used, what it looked like. It was designed by Russ Riley. It consisted of 22 bandpass filters, and here you just see the components here. And at the output of each bandpass filter was a detector. The detector was formed by a small light bulb. And then as a source for our measurements, we used a pink noise source. And the pink noise was easy to come by when you used a microwave point contact diode, which had a pink noise output that was so broad it went from basically DC all the way to 10, 15 megahertz. So a huge amount of output. It didn't need much amplification. It was also microphonic, but that's another effect there. So the idea was that you use a pink noise source to drive the loudspeaker, and these were all bandpass filter, and it was calibrated so that for flat response, all the lights would just light up just dimly, okay? And then we had an attenuator, calibrated attenuator, with a nice linear dB scale, and actually that circus is on my website. It's a really clever little circuit that Russ Riley came up with. And so you would adjust, if you measured a loudspeaker, not all the lights would come up with equal intensity. And so if this one here was black, you would crank up the gain until it was just dim, plot the point for that frequency, and went through the whole 22 things. It's a pretty tedious procedure, but it has a big advantage that you really don't want to do it, and that you think about every data point that you measure, and whether that data point makes sense, and whether you need to measure more points, or whether you can just skip a few points or so, right? So it's very educational. Okay. So we followed Friedman and Lyman Miller, another colleague at HP, provided the microphone. He was into recording at that time, and he had found a simple little electret microphone and figured out how to get that more linear, how to change the FET configuration in the electret microphone, and so that's what we used. Now, this pink noise and light bulb measurement was tedious, and I refined this measurement technique when I used a burst signal, a tone burst like you see here, and I built this generator that had a frequency range from 5.6 hertz to 47 kilohertz, so a really broad frequency range, would put out 5 cycle cosine envelope bursts at, I see the time here is moving by, and then use an LED threshold detector, which was calibrated in linear dB, and you see the steps on the diode here for this calibrator. Okay. For measurement and with the tone burst, you could see, of course, also the time domain behavior. It's a measurement that Richard Heiser called a measurement in the fuzzy domain, where you have both time information and frequency domain information there. And when measuring the peak burst, it gives you a frequency response that correlates very strongly with subjective impression of the sound of the speaker. So while I try to improve the large Edwin and ESS speakers with room equalization and internal stuffing materials, Russ Riley preferred to work with headphones and small speakers. We all had Sennheiser HD414 headphones, very famous pair of headphones, that we had individually equalized to our own ears, and we did this using a smoothly tuning sine wave generator. It's actually something quite easily done. And so we were this way improving commercial products. Russ liked small speakers. I had the bigger Advent and KLH6 and ESS7 speakers. He liked little ones, like the Celestion and Didn 10. And
HD 440?
Yes. Yeah. And the foam is still very good here. Yeah, that used to always.
You'll hear about that tomorrow.
Okay, and the problem was, of course, there is not much bass output there. So since it's a simple electromechanical system, we said, well, that's easy to correct for. And we built first an equalizer like you see here, which I extended to also have a bridge T in the feedback path here. So you didn't only have a pair of zeros, but also a pair of poles. And you could cancel the driver's poles and with the zeros and put another pole pair where you really wanted to have the roll-off of the thing happen. And that thing has become known as, someone coined it, the Linkvitz transform. We had also come up with an alternative to the Butterworth filters, which everybody was using at the time, and which provided the proper addition of, say, tweeter and mid-range signals, because each signals were just 0.5 plus 0.5, so adding to unity on axis. And the other advantage here of these small boxes that they were relatively stiff, and so the panel vibration was not too strong. The panel vibration, I don't know if I mentioned it, I measured using a phono cartridge with a sort of makeshift tone arm, putting it on the panel there, and using tone bursts, because on the tone bursts you can immediately see the, in this long decay, you can see the resonances. And I must say, I struggled for forever trying to tame the box radiation from the panels. Mm-hmm. You know, the amplitudes can be very small, but the areas are large, and so it's oftentimes at certain frequencies there's more radiated off the panels of a speaker than directly from the cone of the speaker, and that's a problem until today in many many speakers. So, here is one of my early box speaker designs. That one is actually in the Wireless World article. I had the speakers hanging, so that they were away from the bookshelf behind it, and this gave a more open sound than if they were put back in the bookshelf to be out of the way if we had company or so. The woofer was a single center woofer where left and right channels were combined, and that was also of advantage because on turntables the vertical rumble would cancel it when you sum left and right channels from each other. Each driver was equalized at line level and had its own amplifier, so this was a two amplifier system about the size of the BBC LS3. There. And I think it's interesting there when you look at the first example that I gave you about the head as a head-shaped type transducer, that the LS3-5 is actually pretty close in size to that, and now the LS50 here from KEF, you know, it's all in that order. So that's not a bad approximation to the radiation pattern of a human head. Okay. So also at that time I had met Laurie Fincham from KEF. He had come over to California with a group of engineers because Hewlett-Packard had just introduced a Fourier analyzer, and they were being trained on that Fourier analyzer, and that was the great opportunity for us, the engineers, to have someone in the field and ask him all the questions. And after I met Laurie, I sent him a letter, and I had listed all the questions we had about loudspeaker and design. Why do you do this? Why do you do that? And at that time, of course, was all airmail. So it took at least a week or 2 weeks before he got an answer back. And so the answer came back from Laurie nicely typed and letterhead and everything. And said, and he said, basically, it's very interesting that you ask all these questions. We have the same questions. and I guess as a result, we had a correspondence. I still have all the letters. You know, it's two folders like this, like, you know, of handwritten stuff there, where we had a very lively exchange about loudspeaker ideas. And it made me realize that we were actually, as microwave engineers, working sort of at the forefront of loudspeaker design. And some of the things that motivated me to publish this paper. And Laurie actually helped. He had connections to Wireless World, which was at that time a very good magazine for audio type things there. My wife is giving me signs here to have to speed up. So I published this thing, and I want to say I had a really rewarding career at HP, and I had really no interest to go into loudspeaker. I just did this for my own amusement here, because I love music and like to go to concerts and listen to music. So just a little bit about my speaker designs. I had, here you see, two-way systems, box heavily braced on the inside, the drivers mounted on the magnet, because the drivers of that time usually had a stamped metal basket, and when you clamped that basket here to the front panel, then you had a mass spring system formed by the spring of the basket here and the mass of the magnet, which sets up a resonance in the low 100 hertz regions. It doesn't really matter what size the driver is, interestingly enough. It scales and it always ends up around 300, 400 hertz. A resonance which is such high Q that when you put your hand on the magnet, you cannot stop it. You know, apply an impulse to it, and it rings like a Christmas tree, and no way to stop it. But if you clamp the driver by the magnet and have it floating here, just an air seal, then that resonance is suppressed there. So that was something that we did. And here's then for more output, MTM time arrangement, which has other benefits there that even if you use the Butterworth filter as a crossover, that the main lobe is always on axis. My design procedure, and just a few words about that, because I do it to this same day, I follow this procedure. I measure the baffle-mounted drivers in free field, so I sort of do some first thinking about what baffle I want to use, select the drivers, put them on the baffle, and then equalize each driver and try to get it covering as wide a frequency range as I think I need, and equalize it to do that. And then for the low end, I equalize the low end with this bi-quad, and here you see an example where this is a driver, here is the target function, and here is the equalization required to get to that target function. And every speaker has usually diffraction issues, and here's some graphs that actually came from Bell Labs from 1938. Olson quoted these here, and I found the original reference. It's quite an impressive piece of work to come up with a closed form solution for these graphs here that was done at Bell Labs a long time ago. Okay, and so then after I have equalized and the drivers, then I just apply the crossover and like an LR4 crossover. The LR4 crossover, just to say, that has the advantage that when your drivers are vertically aligned, that the main axis of the polar radiation pattern stays constant, while if you use, say, a first order Butterworth, you are sitting somewhere here on the slope of the polar pattern, and just something to to alert you on, you may know this, that the polarity between adjacent lobes always alternates. So if this is plus, this is 180 degrees out of phase in the adjacent lobe. So you really want to try to avoid lobing on the loudspeaker. But in the vertical plane, that's very difficult to do because you have to put the drivers very close together. Okay. Now, dipole loudspeakers. I had, and give me just a brief introduction to this, I must say I have been quite impressed and personally impressed and liked what I came up with my designs compared to commercial loudspeakers there. And that only lasted so long until I was forced to build a pair of dipole column loudspeakers in a very short time. And so this is what I did. These are columns, they are open in the back, and it was for a public address application, a satellite downlink, where we had a big TV screen here, we had a podium with microphones here, and I put the speakers in between, so that the podium and the screen were in the null of the dipole radiation pattern, because I wanted to have low acoustic feedback. And I wanted to have a long column so that people in the far corner of the auditorium had good intelligibility. The auditorium was a basketball court, so all hard surfaces, and the loudspeakers that were actually in the court were so reverberant in the room there that you couldn't understand a word. So this really worked like a charm. And when I took these speakers home, I set them up in my living room. Now, I had to build them in two sections so that I could transport them in the trunk of my car. And so when I set them up as a stereo system, as crude as they were, they reminded me about the Quad ESL 63, which I had heard. And they reminded me in the sense that they sounded very open. And so I said, well, I wonder what would happen if I really set my mind to designing a dipole loudspeaker using conventionally piston-type drivers. And that's what I did, and this is what I came up with. It's a four-way system, tweeter, upper mid-range, lower mid-range, and the center woofer. That one I didn't build as dipole because I didn't think it was possible to build a dipole woofer. And here's a power response of this is what I call the LO7, the solid curve, as compared to the KEF 107, popular speaker at the time, and compared to a typical two-way speaker with the notch here in the power response, where you go from woofer to tweeter here. So the power response estimate was quite a bit more uniform. And these estimates are actually quite right. Floyd Toole told me later he measured the KEF 107 in his chamber in Canada and basically came up with the same thing. And of course an active system. Now the woofer came, the dipole woofer came actually later, and this was another colleague at HP. He had built this type of woofer, actually three of these boxes stacked on top of each other, so he had six 12-inch drivers for left channel, six for the right channel, and they were all along the sidewalls, floor to ceiling, and he could reproduce bass like I had never heard. It wasn't the power, it was the naturalness of the bass there. It didn't matter whether it was concert hall bass or whether it was somewhere slapping a door, you literally felt the air moving, and or whether it's street noise, it was just very impressive. And so I said, well, too bad I don't have the room at our house to put speakers like this here. And it was a friend of mine, Don Berenger, who was a recording engineer for United States Marine Band, who sort of built the stuff that I had designed for his purposes in recording. He built this actually for the LO7, and then he called me on the phone and said, oh, wow, you need to try this thing. This really works. It even works for And with just two 12-inch drivers there, you get plenty of output. So that started a while later, a whole series of loudspeakers that are designed for audio artistry. It was again a colleague at HP, a salesperson, you admit, who started a company, Audio Artistry, and asked me to join them and design speakers for them. And so we designed these type of loudspeakers. This was just a three-way system, and here an all-out system with four 12-inch woofers here on each side, and four lower mid-range, two upper mid-range, and tweeter, the Beethoven product. This was a Beethoven brand, a little bit smaller version of the Beethoven. Actually became immediately well received in the market, was recognized as Speaker of the Year, and great reviews on this thing there. But financially, the whole situation was not too good. We built these speakers. I subsidized, in effect, every speaker we sold, and so I can only do this so long. And so I said, okay, this is it. I pull out from it and can't continue this. Yeah. So I, in the process, I had learned so much about loudspeakers that I thought, well, I better write it down before it's forgotten there, and maybe other people can benefit from it. And I decided to do this as a website. And so in 1999, I started this process of writing down, and I had to give an example of a loudspeaker, of a dipole loudspeaker that people could build themselves to demonstrate to themselves that what I claim actually works. And that became the Phoenix loudspeaker, you know, the Phoenix out of the ashes. That went for a while, and then I said, and the Phoenix was actually separate woofer boxes, separate from the mid-range, and then I wanted to integrate it all into a smaller package that was more acceptable in our household, and that became the Orion dipole, where you have here an H-frame dipole woofer and a mid-range on an open baffle and a tweeter, and this tweeter is only forward radiating. In audio artistry, I didn't use a rear radiating tweeter, even though in my initial LO7 I'd used it, but I figured that tweeter probably causes more problem than real benefits there. Okay. Then I was trying to understand room acoustics, particularly at very low frequencies, particularly the behavior of a dipole at very low frequencies. And in order to study that, I built myself a 10-to-1 scale model of my living room, rough model, basically a big box. And I needed, of course, now a dipole loudspeaker for that box and a monopole speaker. And I found these Aura tweeters, 2-inch tweeters, that could go down flat to 200 hertz. And I figured with some equalization I can go down to 50 hertz, because I really wanted to study like real life, as if it was down to the response down to 5 hertz in a room. And in doing so, I basically didn't find out anything new. It was all just a superposition of waves and reflections and free field propagation, that is just superposition, everything as you expected it to do. But now that I had a tweeter that was really usable to quite low frequency, I said, oh, I can build myself a loudspeaker that has very low diffraction, and I want to compare it to the dipole and see, are there sonic differences, right? Because you can think of a dipole as really having maximum amount of diffraction, the front and rear wave interfering at the edge. But again, if you look at it closely, you could say, well, all the diffraction effect really counts. But that's another discussion. So I built this thing. It's a small 5-inch driver here in the end of a pipe, just a standard PVC pipe from the hardware store. And here's this tweeter, and they are offset from center, because if you put it right across it, you get bad response because the tweeter sound reflects here of the tone. But electrically, it's moved back to be in the center here of the tweeter. Now, the big surprise, they had two big surprises. The first one was that this speaker, even though it's a totally different concept from the Orion, sounded surprisingly similar to the Orion. The other surprise was it didn't sound like a box speaker at all, even though basically it's a box speaker. It's a sealed pipe here, closed at the end. And I loaded the pipe, of course, with absorbing material, so that it became an infinite transmission line. And the return loss, in other words, what travels down the pipe, gets reflected, comes back out of the cone again, is in the order of 40 dB down. So as a microwave engineer, I would say, well, 40 dB return was, it's actually a pretty good termination for a line. And then, since this here has enormously stiff enclosure here, the pipe doesn't flex or bend, there is insignificant radiation of all the surfaces here. So it's just all comes off the cones here and from up there. Okay. But there was one thing in the voice range. There was still a difference between this speaker and the Orion dipole speaker, and so I said this must be due to the fact that the Orion dipole doesn't radiate high frequencies also to the back. So what I did, I added a tweeter to the rear. And when you measure this under free field conditions, in other words, from this is the rear side of the sphere, measure from this side, on axis, you don't really see anything from this speaker. But as you move off axis, you get more and more of the rear radiation. So it affects, this rear tweeter affects very much the polar pattern and how you illuminate the room that you're in. And that is indeed what you're hearing, that when, once you're in the room, you can measure, in a room measurement, you can measure the presence or absence of that rear tweeter. But it's only via the reverberant field. Now, I used here an 8-inch and the tweeter, and I knew that I was pushing the 8-inch driver at its high end. I was pushing it to 1.4 kilohertz for the crossover, and this one down to 1.4 kilohertz. And so in this whole transition region, the polar pattern wasn't really quite like the I would like to have for a dipole there. And so in the background, I had always experimented with a project which I called F3, like form follows function. And let's just see what happens if I put no restrictions on myself and just try to design something that does a job right. Well, the result of that is this LX521 dipole. And this is a four-inch dipole. Here you see the baffle structure without drivers, two openings for the woofers. You can see the top woofer here, mid-range, upper mid-range, and two tweeters. And there's actually one tweeter in the front and one tweeter in the back. And a lot of empirical work went into this baffle shape here to come up really with a cosine alpha figure of 8 type radiation pattern. So I'm sure there are other shapes that can do it, but this is engineering, and you at some point you stop and say, well, this is close enough. Okay, and so this here is an acoustically small dipole, and I intentionally didn't want this to be confused with a piece of furniture. It's a machine. It's meant to be a transducer from an electrical input to an auditory illusion. I would call it an illusion engine. Okay, and I know that I have succeeded with this thing, and that has been confirmed by highly experienced listeners, by recording engineers, by avid concert goers, by women and by naive listeners. And I would like to say something here about women. I think they are the much better listeners than men. They are not that easily influenced by technical aspects. They just listen to the music. And when I was at exhibits, a consumer electronics show, and we demoed speakers with all the artistry, I was always standing in the background and sort of watch the body reactions that people have. And if I saw that they were moving with the music, that they were going with it, I knew things were okay. It communicated. Okay, so let me summarize what I found here. This is now the really important part here. Okay. Hearing and stereo. Hearing direction and distance of a source in a reflective environment is a natural survival mechanism. We use head movement to change signal streams at the ears for localization. We know where the physical sources like loudspeakers and headphones are in space, and we do not want to lose that information. We are always interested in where is the physical source of a sound. It's just automatic, okay? You can't help it. It's preconscious you're doing this. We segregate signal streams and focus our attention at will. The cocktail part effect is well known example of an auditory phenomenon. We move the ticking clock beyond our acoustic horizon. You walk into a room, you hear a clock ticking. After a while, you don't notice it anymore. And then someone said, oh, did you hear the clock? Then it's there again. We attenuate the reverberant environment when it merely replicates the direct sound, and that's a very key observation I feel I've made here. Hearing stereo is an auditory illusion which is derived from cues in the loudspeaker and room signal streams. It's derived from memory patterns and adaptation to the acoustic environment. And we must, as loudspeaker designer, we must avoid to give misleading cues due to loudspeaker cabinet diffraction, panel and cavity resonances, nonlinear distortion, and spurious noises. The auditory illusion is perfect when misleading cues have been eliminated. I say it's like a magician's trick, but with closed eyes, where the loudspeakers and the listening room have disappeared from the auditory scene in the listener's mind. And this actually works, this actually takes place. Now, in order to for this to occur, we have to make sure that the room reflected and reverberated sound must have the same timbre as the direct sound from the speakers, in order to eliminate misleading cues. This implies, when you think about it, that loudspeakers have frequency-independent directivity, such as you would have for a dipole, a cardioid, or an omni, or whatever different pattern you like to choose there. Also, room reflections must be delayed to segregate the reflections from the direct sound streams. Reflections must be symmetrical in the room, or it must be suppressed to preserve left-to-right balance of the auditory scene. This requires symmetry of the setup for loudspeakers and listener relative to the room boundaries. The plus-minus 30 degree incident, here at the sweet spot, it must appear as spectrally coming from the center of the room, like if you have a center-penned single voice. It's really generated by cues from left and right loudspeakers, which arrive at 30 degrees here. But when you look at the model of the head as a simple sphere, you see a pressure build up at the ears, so you have to have a roll-off, high-frequency roll-off there, so that you perceive this. It helps to perceive the center more accurately. And now let's just briefly look at the loudspeaker and listener and room configuration, at reflections and reverberation. I have observed over the years that first order reflections should be delayed by a minimum of 6 milliseconds relative to the direct sound. That corresponds to a 2 meter path length difference. It's not always achievable, but a dipole speaker has a null plane which can be pointed to the first lateral reflection, so you don't get lateral reflection. The timbre of the reflection should match the direct sound, at least to the first order. Reflections from the wall behind the speakers, in other words, in front of the listener, from behind the speakers, should not be absorbed, but should be diffused. Mm-hmm. The space behind the listener, behind me, should be open or attenuated so that the sound basically travels past me and essentially disappears. Okay. As I said, a dipole loudspeaker can be towed in to attenuate the first side reflections, and some strong sidewall reflections tend to widen the and to defocus the auditory scene that you perceive. As now about reverberation, as signals bounce around in the room, they build up the reverberant sound field. In an acoustically small room, like a living room, it only makes sense to talk about reverberation above the Schröder frequency, and so that's typically above 150 to 200 hertz, and it's a frequency range above the modal part of the frequency range. We know that the direct sound from the loudspeaker decays directly inversely with distance, while the reverberated sound reaches an equilibrium, and the maximum listening distance should be such that the direct sound is less than 60 dB below the total or below the reverberant sound. In other words, you should want to be at a distance like this. Actually, it's something that Klippel here wrote about in a paper, I believe. Untreated rooms have reverberation times of about 400 milliseconds, which is no problem for the typical listening distances if the loudspeakers are uniformly directed. It's a very important thing. And notice that a dipole can have 1.7 times the listening distance compared to a monopole for the same signal to reverberation ratio. Or conversely, and that's what I find very interesting, is that a dipole in a room with 750 milliseconds RT60 has the same signal to noise ratio as a monopole in a 250 milliseconds room. In other words, a recording studio which is built around 250 milliseconds RT60, you could have the same effect taking a dipole and put it into a 750 millisecond reverb room, a very lively room, and still have the same direct to reverb ratio. I have found, and here's an interesting thing, I have found that room modes excited by a dipole below the Schröder frequency have little, if any, auditory detrimental effect. I believe this is due to the constant power response of the dipole, due to its directionality and how it excites room modes, and it is due to the balancing effect, psychoacoustically balancing effects of the high amount of high frequency energy that you have in the room. The problem with a conventional box speaker, with a typical box speaker, that it has too much energy in the room at low frequencies, becomes directional at high frequencies, and that is a loss of high frequency of access energy there. So the prototype for stereo loudspeakers is actually this speaker here. I say this with confidence, that the ideal loudspeaker is an acoustically small dipole. And this is just an example of it. Of course, you could build it differently. such loudspeaker radiates sound in a way that the listener's brain can focus attention on the direct sound streams coming from the loudspeakers and move the physical location of the sound source and the listening room beyond the auditory horizon. It's a psychoacoustic effect. We're using the processor between the ears for this here. Natural hearing processes which evolve for survival are engaged in a friendly way in this kind of system, and the experience is enjoyable again and again. And here is, I urge you to build and test it out for yourself, convince yourself, and please step out of the conventional box loudspeaker paradigm. You are on a plateau. You can never get to this here. It's a totally new experience, and experience really what you have been missing in terms of spatial rendering, of three-dimensionality of sound, that is actually contained in just most ordinary stereo recordings. It's really quite amazing how much information the brain is able to fish out of this if it is not masked by the room and the loudspeakers themselves. And I say that the room is rarely the problem. The problem is the loudspeakers. People do all sorts of things to their room and think that that's the solution. No, it's a loudspeaker. And I realize that I have exceeded my time here. I hope I didn't put you to sleep. I don't know if we have time for questions, but this seminar still goes on for a while, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you, Siegfried. Actually, as far as timing goes, there's only one timing limit, which is that we have to start walking towards the restaurant in half an hour. So, let's say,